See, now, every time we talk, you be outing me.
On the,
you
on
keep
the,
telling people that I'm motivated by love.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's true. That's true. And Sister Lavette, your wonderful wife, would agree, though, brother. You got that deep love in you.
Most of the time, yes, she would. Mm-hmm. There's a few times. But I was thinking about a few things as you talk.
Yes, yes. Oh, my God.
There was the question of love, but I was also thinking about dreaming and revenge.
Yeah, yeah.
And see, on this dreaming piece, one thing that folks used to always say about me is, you just a dreamer. Mm. And I was kind of like, oh man, you know, what's wrong here? Am I not accomplishing things? Am I head in the clouds? But then I ran across a piece from Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, the leader of the Russian Revolution, where he talked about dreaming. And he basically said, ain't nothing wrong with dreaming as long as your dreams come from a basis of reality and they are big dreams, but then you're constantly measuring the difference between your dreams and reality and working to narrow that distance.
Yeah, yeah.
By bringing reality in line with what you're dreaming, but also bringing your dreams back in line with reality, because if you're dreaming off somewhat, you might have to readjust those dreams because what you're thinking about can't be realized. And then once I came across that, I was like, hey, dreaming ain't so bad.
Dreaming ain't that bad. And a lot of it has to do with the content of the dream, because you can have fascist dreams.
Yes.
As opposed to deeply democratic ones, you know what I mean? Patriarchal dreams, homophobic dreams. But for me, this issue of love and hatred tied to a systemic analysis of power becomes crucial because, you know, George Bernard Shaw used to say, hatred is the coward's revenge against those who intimidate you. You see? So hatred's always a species of cowardice, always, when it's geared toward a person. But at the same time, if you hate injustice and you're willing to pay a cost the way Martin and the others did, then that has to do with love. And part of the problem these days is that we don't have enough people, especially for our young people, who embody that. You see, when I was coming along in the 60s, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and Martin and Mary Rad Edelman and the others, it was very clear that they had such a depth of integrity that they would never sell out to the highest bidder. Never. Whereas the market-driven society we have for our young people, you ask them who your heroes are, they tend to be those who are most visible in the market, who have the biggest money. You say, well, how much political courage do they have? Well, I hadn't really thought about that. You see. And there's nothing wrong with having a certain kind of genius. You know, Sister Oprah Winfrey has entrepreneurial genius. I can celebrate her entrepreneurial genius, and I'll love her till the day I die. But when you juxtapose her with Ella Baker, you see that there's not a lot of political courage at work. And it has to do with her market calculations. Who's watching this show? Same is true for all these folk on television. You can just see them all cramped up. Don't really want to tell the truth because they have limits. That's the danger of putting all these folks, especially these days, it's almost Rent a Negro on TV. You know what I mean? When you look up and you see all these black people talking, you say, wait a minute, you weren't talking that way 3 years ago. How come you're so tight and so narrow now? They got a job on the corporate media tab. I said, Lord have mercy. What happened? It's too truncated. We've got to provide examples to young people of free human beings of whatever color. And we need more of it. We need more of them.
Yeah. I'm glad when you said that hatred piece that you distinguished between hating injustice and hating people, because I think there is a real difference there. Because for me, the hatred of injustice is tied to the love for the people who are being unjustly treated.
Right.
And I actually like the way you out me, because that is where I'm coming from. And sometimes I don't always get around to it. But I think people need to get that. And then we need to grapple with this thing about revenge. because from one end, there are people who have been horribly abused in this society and in this world, and they should be angry about that. But then if all that takes you to is I want to strike back, I want my chance, then you're not going to be able to fundamentally uproot all of that madness that I talked about and that Avakian talked about in that quote about what this society is like, the oppressive, exploitative relations and everything that goes along with it. So you gotta hate the abuse that's coming down, but you also have to hate it enough and love the people enough for being abused to wanna get scientific about it. Mm-hmm. Where is this coming from? How can we understand that? And how can we move to deal with it? Who are the allies that we can bring forward in this struggle? So I think that's important, and that's one of the things, because sometimes when people hear me say, it's not our youth's fault, they didn't create this situation, they think I'm giving them a pass, and that they can stay into the shit that they're into. That's not it at all.
That's right.
I'm understanding the situation that they're faced with and what they're in. But then the other thing I got to say with them is, now that we know why you're facing this situation, we got to say, what are we going to do about it?
That's right.
Are you going to go out the way that they've put up there for you to go out? Or are we going to stand up? Are we going to say, no, we ain't going out like that?
That's right.
We are not less than human, and we will not be dehumanized and become inhuman. In fact, we are going to bring forth, we're going to be emancipators of humanity. We're not just looking to get the shit off of us and fuck everybody else. We're looking to overturn the structures that have weighed down heaviest on us, but also are weighing down on people all around the world. Quite heavily too, you know, so.
That's right.
That's
one of the things that I like about Brother Avakian's distinction between envy and resentment on the one hand and righteous indignation on the other is that it resonates with my own legacy of Jerusalem as filtered through slavery, Jim Crow, and the black musical tradition. Because what happens oftentimes is if you engage in righteous indignation in this society, people want to reduce that down to you having just envy and resentment. In the same way that when different groups come together, like let's say you people like the black community, all the black community has is interest. That's not true. That's the way the dominant corporate media puts it forward. But there's principles as well as interests, you see. And never allow anybody, any group, to reduce you as an individual just to your interests. It may not be in your interest to save your child, but you're gonna try to do it anyway because you got principles. It may not be in your interest to save your mama, somebody trying to violate her, but you love her, so you're gonna do something because you have principles. But what has happened in the last 40 years, anytime you talk about black folk, it's just a matter of a special interest group. Martin Luther King Jr. didn't lead a special interest group. He led a group of de-niggerized black people. That's very important. Because to be niggerized is what? To be so scared and afraid and intimidated, you want to do nothing. To be de-niggerized is stand up. We willing to live. We willing to die, Martin said. My kind of folk. Now, what else did he say to him? Better put on your cemetery clothes. That's what he used to say all the time. Because down in gut bucket, American apartheid, you could get killed quick. But it was based on principle. It wasn't just black interest. And we need to get back to talking about principles and ideals as well as just interests. So white brothers and sisters, is it in my interest to help poor people? Well, what kind of human being do you want to be? If it's just a matter of your individual interests, you can join a crypto-fascist movement. Oligarchs can be freedom fighters if they so choose. They just have to commit a certain kind of class suicide, you know. But as individuals, they can choose based on their principles. We need to get back to talking. That's what I get. What I love about the Occupy movement again, you see. Not the envy and resentment, but the principles. And you see that throughout the work of my dear brother Avakian. On that point, we in deep solidarity. I know I got disagreements on another. Now, do you want to say something about the God question?
Well, I was going to say, there's two places I was thinking about taking it.
Yes.
And one was coming off of, because you keep doing things like, you know, it resonates, Avakian's distinction between indignation
and envy,
and resentment resonates with where you're coming from, and you did it up there earlier. And I could come from another way on that.
Okay.
Because when the thing that Marx does about socialism and communism, socialism being from each according to their ability, to each according to their work, and communism being from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, is actually drawn from some biblical
sources. Sounds like the book of Acts. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. You know, there's a way in which, and what he was getting at there was, you know, you can draw knowledge from a lot of different places.
Absolutely.
But he was getting at the kind of world that could be brought into being. And then, you know, when we talked the last time, I think I got into the point, and a lot of people focus up communism and Marxism on the thing about the opiate of the people. But I remember I read Marx for the first time for a college writing course. And I read him because the teacher says, all right, you got to do an essay, and here are the different authors you could take to write the essay on. But I must tell you, if anybody takes Karl Marx, I will fail them.
Oh, really?
Okay, now, this teacher, she didn't know me very well, because I was like, I got to take Karl Marx then, you know? And I read him, and I was like, this stuff makes some sense. And one of the things I remembered reading was his point about religion being the heart of a heartless world. And at that point, I had earlier been raised up in the church, and folks were like, oh, this gonna be the new head of the church. This gonna be like the pastor. Because at the age of 10, I would do all the school, all the church plays, and you know, the nativity things, and I'd know all the roles, and people would forget their lines, and I would whisper it to them. So they're like, he's gonna go far with this.
He
knows the Bible and all this kind of stuff.
A preacher and a pastor.
But then I was up against questions that I could not deal with in the context of religion. And then I read Marx's thing, you know, and I dropped out of the church, but I didn't go to atheism. I was just like, I don't know about it. But then I read his thing about the heart of a heartless world, and that what needs to be done is we need to put heart in the world by getting rid of capitalism and all that it means. And in a world with heart, what would be the role of religion? You know, and that's a Marxist approach to that.
Yeah.
Now, I know you got a take on that, because I'm sure you've run into this before, so I just wanted to put that out there in terms of we are actually working to put heart in the world by ending the heartlessness of the oppression, the vicious exploitation of capitalism, imperialism. And then through the course of that, people will still be able to practice religion in a revolutionary society.
Sure.
You know, it would be a wrong approach to try to suppress that, but that heart in a heartless world would no longer be necessitated. And that's part of where we see.
No, but I see the power of that. I see the power of that claim, though. I mean, there's no doubt that the history of religious institutions have been excessively accommodating to structures of domination. It could be imperialism, or white supremacy, male supremacy, anti-Semitism, anti-Arabism, and so forth. But when we're talking about religion as I understand it, the Christian faith as I understand it, you're actually talking about those prophetic voices and conversational partners that go alongside the margins of all of these different religious institutions. Most of Christianity is Constantinian Christianity, which is so accommodated to the prejudices of the world, owing to a cowardice, that people use it as a coping mechanism rather than a source of generating courage. Most of Judaism is constitutional Judaism. Jews in America, moving into the upper middle class, falling in love with the felicities of bourgeois existence, falling in love with respectability from the goyim, never thinking that you actually could be mainstream given the vicious history of anti-Semitism. No, Amos says, have a critical suspicion of that. It's right there in the text.
Jonah says every Yom Kippur, red, have a suspicion of that. That's very difficult. Most forms of Buddhism in America, Constantinian Buddhism, accommodated to prejudice. But the prophetic is suspicious. And that's true actually in terms of secular institutions. Liberalism's accommodation to vicious forms of imperialism, for example. And we know, you know, the failures of Marxism in terms of the gangster-like communist regimes of Stalin and a whole host of others, killing millions and millions and millions of people. But there's a prophetic element in the Marxist analysis that says the precious humanity of poor and working people must be accented even in the face of the gangster-like communist regime. Marxist critique of communist regimes in that sense. You would accept that, though.
Well, I'd want to talk about this gangster-like regime's point. No, because...
Yeah. I mean, because Stalin was a gangster. You agree with that?
No, I don't agree that he was a gangster. He led the first socialist revolution after the death of Lenin, and he was trying to do something that had never been done before, and there were shortcomings in the understanding of the communist movement at that point. No, and he had to move with this. He had to say, all right, we've socialized the means of production, but there's a lot of disagreements here. Where are they coming from? And at that point, the communist movement had no understanding of where you would get that kind of resistance with the means of production socialized. And
but
Stalin, flowing
but
from
went
that.
But Stalin, he went to seminary. He knows it's not right to wipe out your friends.
Okay.
I mean, you get that in seminary. You know, you don't need a whole lot of
Marxist
analysis.
I'm not sure what he got in seminary.
Well, he might have got the wrong thing in seminary, depending on which one he went to.
That's another question.
Yeah, you're right about that, though. That's
no, but it was like...
No, that's a good point. But wiping out your friends is wrong.
He was dealing with contradictions...
Tilling peasants is wrong.
...under socialism that he didn't know where they were coming from. Now, Mao was able to look at what they did in the Soviet Union and say, okay... This is where those contradictions were coming from. It's not enough just to make the farm collective property. It's not enough to make the factory collective property. You actually have to deal with relations between people left over from the old society, those who work with their minds, those who work with their backs. You have to deal with the fact that you got to have exchange between the farms and the factories, and those are differences that contain the seed of antagonism if you don't handle them right. And Mao was able to work at that much better. And then Avakian has gone even beyond that. But see, part of what we have done in going at this is actually look at what were those societies trying to do? How did they go about it? And what did they achieve? Because in both Russia and China, you were talking about societies where the people were poor, illiterate, beaten down.
No doubt.
And in both of those societies, people's material conditions were transformed, literacy was brought to them. In China, they went even farther. They started out with 70 million drug addicts. They wiped out drug addiction as a social problem, and not by punishing the people who were on drugs, but by giving them a source of hope in the new societies that they forged, and by treating addiction as a medical problem, you know. So those are things that you can learn from that. Mm-hmm. And on the basis of learning that, Avakian also looked at, and here's where they went wrong. Stalin on not being able to get the difference between contradictions between the enemy and contradictions among the people. Mao, by getting that, but still going up against things like thinking that there should be an official ideology for the society. No, there shouldn't be an official ideology. There should be contention between a lot of different viewpoints. That's what Avakian has brought forward in terms of solid core with a lot of elasticity, that we need a setup where there's diversity, debate, discussion, and dissent, including from the people who say socialism is fucked up.
Precious liberties.
We need to hear from them because they will know some things and understand some things that the people who are with you don't get. And if you don't hear from them, that's going to mean you don't know enough about reality to transform it in the desired direction.
With another authoritarian regime, though. No, but see, this is another reason why, though, you and I resonate so much in terms of the critique of not just unfettered markets, but of capitalist relations in which there's asymmetric relations of power at the workplace, bosses and workers. Mm-hmm.
in terms of the alternative, it's a larger discussion. I know we want to open it up. But once we get to talk about Stalin and Mao and so forth, oh, we part company.
Okay.
we do part company on that, though, brother.
That's part of why we can have a dialogue.
That's exactly. Because I think we have to be very clear in our language. You know, no matter what the historical conditions are, no matter what the difficulties are, it's just wrong to kill folk. You know what I mean? That's an arbitrary use of power. And we see arbitrary use of power in feudal societies, we see it in capitalist societies. A lot of people in America don't like to see it. You see. Brother Grant shot down. That's arbitrary police power. And Brother Anthony Troy is executed by the state.
Troy's execution.
That's arbitrary power.
What Mumia Abu-Jamal is facing.
And Brother Mumia, of course, we're going to be highlighting.
We're going to be in Philadelphia.
30 years. We're going to be in Philly together.
Yeah.
For Brother Mumia, a free man on black on death row. But still, there's arbitrary powers at the top. Anytime you have centralized power that's unaccountable, I don't care if it's in the public sector, the private sector, civil society, and so on. And that's where our discussion, if we had a whole lot of time, we'd wrestle with. But you think we should open it up for it?
Well, we should open it up. Yeah. I would just say that the thing about solid core with elasticity is exactly to see, because we understand there's a contradiction between the leadership and the land,
indeed,
even in a revolutionary society. And part of how you deal with that is unleashing that diversity, that debate, and that dissent, so that the leadership is not unchecked. That's mm-hmm. also why mm-hmm. we want to publish a constitution for the future socialist republic now, so people can say, this is what they say they're going to do. Let's see how they build up to it, and then let's see
Absolutely.
How they act.
And that's the right to dissent.
Yeah.
The right to express dissent, right to cut against the grain, the
yes.
right to frankly speak. No, absolutely.
That's all in that
absolutely.
Constitution, and we want people
no,
to know
no,
that
no,
so
yeah,
they can
absolutely.
Say
absolutely.
If it ain't going down. And then another thing's in there is not doing the death penalty.
Oh, well, we know how barbaric that is now. The death penalty, the nation state having the capacity to take a human life.
No,
there might be an element of doubt.
Yeah.
That's barbaric. At least for me, that's just barbaric. There's just no doubt about that. You're right about that. Absolutely. But I know.
So how are we going to go on this?
Yeah, we're going to follow your instructions. Yeah. Absolutely. Good to see you there, brother.
You ain't got no sound over there, man. Well, you want that one there? There we go.
There you go.
All right, so let's give both our brothers a big, huge hand. Were you blessed?